You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Sarah Vaughn.
And I'm Joe Crawford. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, July 19th, 2016.
We train to shoot to stop the aggressive behavior. So you don't normally train for a specific part of the body because that's hard to do, so you shoot for center mass.
Bloomington Police Chief Mike Dekoff responds to questions about how officers are trained to use firearms. That's later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, the ins and outs of money, our weekly segment providing economic education and community resources that keep your budget balanced and your finances flourishing. But first, these local headlines.
The City of Bloomington's Department of Economic and Sustainability is hoping to win $10,000 in prize money for its rental search website, rentrocket.org. The website has been picked as a finalist in the MIT-sponsored Climate CoLab competition. CoLab is a product of the MIT Center for Collective Intelligence and brings citizens together with experts in an effort to address climate change. Bloomington Sustainability Coordinator Jackie Bauer told the Sustainability Commission last week that rentrocket.org is a three-year-long effort to help renters consider elements of sustainability when making housing decisions.
The principle behind the site is that it will allow renters to consider the full cost of housing when they make housing decisions, and it'll give landlords a means for sharing information on investments they've made in properties that contribute to energy efficiency, or, you know, ease use of active transportation, local food, all those kinds of things. So trying to sort of build in all these sustainability factors into housing decisions.
Bauer said the $10,000 prize would effectively double the website's development budget, which is currently funded by a small grant. Bauer said there are two votes going on. One is a popular vote, which residents can participate in, and the second is a judged vote, which carries the monetary prize. Residents can vote for Rent Rocket by visiting climatecolab.org/contests. Voting ends July 31st. Winners will be announced in mid-August.
A new nonprofit organization has launched in Bloomington. The organization, called Accessible Community Abortions of Bloomington, aims to provide help for women in need of financial assistance for abortions or other reproductive health concerns not covered by health insurance. According to Executive Director Mia Beach, women in Indiana face stigma and restrictions when seeking abortions. The goal of the organization is to minimize those obstacles as well as the expense of the procedure.
One of the big impediments to people wanting to have children is a financial burden. So quite often the people who don't feel like they have the resources to take care of a child who would want an abortion are also the people who are going to have a hard time ponying up $500. And there are other resources that provide financial assistance in the area, but we really wanted something that could help fill in that gap, because most places will offer partial scholarships, partial financial grants to help fund those procedures, but it's not going to cover the whole thing. So we just thought that there would be a need for as much help as possible.
Accessible Community Abortions of Bloomington is made up of 6 board members and a small number of community volunteers, and will meet with women by appointment to discuss their situation. Volunteers can assist with transportation, childcare, and other issues faced by women seeking assistance. Women hoping to receive funding must make an appointment to discuss their circumstances and the possibility of financial assistance. Beach says operating so simply allows the nonprofit to maintain low overhead costs.
It's all a passion project for people who are involved, so it's very small, and everything is volunteer-based, so that any money that gets raised can go directly to the people who need it, as opposed to overhead for rent and salaries. We're trying to keep things relatively simple And because we're keeping it simple, it hasn't really been very difficult. We're pretty open-ended on how we want to run things and how we can offer support to people.
Accessible Community Abortions of Bloomington is currently conducting a fundraiser to help them provide financial aid to women. More information is available at www.acab-bloomington.com.
A long-planned addition to Ellettsville's water delivery system is not expected to reduce levels of disinfectant byproducts in the town's water. That's according to the town's utility superintendent, Michael Farmer, who spoke at a town council meeting last week. Disinfectant byproducts are produced as water is chlorinated. The byproducts are linked to health problems, including cancer. Town Council member Brian Mobley said his constituents are asking if a new water line will help reduce contaminants in the drinking water. The new line from Bloomington has been planned for years and is intended to increase the total water supply in Ellettsville. Farmer said the new pipeline would not impact contaminant levels, but he acknowledged the town had recently experienced high levels of disinfectant byproducts in its water.
As far as the disinfectant byproducts...
Is it going down, I guess?
They are coming down. The numbers are coming down. We did have a violation again, and the violation has to do with the last four quarters. So until the numbers come down consistently for some time, you can have a violation based on past numbers. So I think we just put a violation in the paper a few days ago. And
maybe that's where the person seen it at.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, that may be the call.
But the numbers are coming down, so the average has not come down.
Although Farmer says the new water delivery line will not reduce levels of contaminants, he said he expects the new line will be a big help to the town during times of peak usage.
We usually use between 800,000 to over 1 million gallons a day this time of year. And we've used as many as 1.5 million gallons during the hot summer of 2012. This will allow us to ensure that we have enough water at all times for drinking and firefighting.
The town of Ellettsville buys its water from the city of Bloomington as part of what Farmer termed a consecutive system.
The city of Bloomington will celebrate the 26th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act on July 25th in the City Hall atrium. At the event, qualifying local businesses will be awarded with a newly designed decal for their storefronts, part of a program called Accessibility that aims to make Bloomington more accessible to people with disabilities. Michael Shermis, the Special Projects Coordinator for Bloomington's Department of Community and Family Resources, says that this event is important both for celebrating the changes brought about by the ADA and for showing the community that more change is needed.
Still an ongoing effort to make our community more accessible. It's not a static thing, it's ongoing, and the city is making a commitment to making it more accessible. We want to recognize the people that have made that effort.
The Americans with Disabilities Act aims to create employment opportunities, make local and state governments more accessible, and eliminate prejudices or barriers in businesses such as restaurants. Title I of the law states that employers cannot fire or refuse to hire someone based on disability and must supply their employees with necessary accommodations, such as sign language interpretation or adaptive equipment. Title II requires the government to include similar accommodations, such as making city administrative buildings accessible for wheelchair users or equipping 911 lines with technology able to respond to deaf callers. Title III requires businesses and storefronts to eliminate barriers for people with disabilities, such as building ramps in their entryways. The Bloomington accessibility decals that will be handed out at the city celebration are not official certificates of the ADA, but they deal closely with the Title III requirements.
We don't have a official certification for ADA. That's very elaborate and not something that we do. But we have put together a survey that does the bare minimums, focusing on parking, path of travel, use of common areas, and restrooms. Those are the kind of standards that that those things are accessible. Once our volunteer surveyors do that, we have a committee review it, make sure that they have passed, and then they get awarded a decal.
As of this year, more than 150 businesses in Bloomington have been awarded these decals, including Rainbow Cafe, the Northwest YMCA, and Michael's Uptown Cafe. The event on July 25th is open to the public and will include refreshments and a display naming all of the businesses currently taking part in accessibility.
Conservation officers in southern Indiana are tracking a black bear that's believed to have crossed the Ohio River from Kentucky. The black bear was spotted near Corydon on Monday morning, and it's being monitored from the air by officers from the Department of Natural Resources. A statement from the Indiana DNR indicated that conservation officers have been expecting to see more black bears coming in from Kentucky, the result of an expanding bear population. Residents are advised to avoid feeding the bear or leaving garbage in places the bear could easily access. Black bears are shy by nature and will generally flee from contact with humans. Conservation officers are prepared to trap and relocate the bear, but are monitoring the animal for the time being. If the bear does not prove to be a nuisance, it may be left alone. Southern Indiana is heavily forested and has large areas of public land that could serve as a habitat for bears. Last year, the first bear sighting in 140 years happened in northern Indiana, where a black bear was tracked for several weeks before returning to Michigan. Officials reported that that bear stopped demonstrating fear of humans or dogs and once attempted to enter an occupied home. The bear was later captured and euthanized. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Joe Crawford.
And I'm Sarah Vaughn. Recent incidents across the country, from Baton Rouge to Minneapolis to Dallas, have drawn increased attention to issues surrounding police and police violence. Many police departments are pledging to alter the way officers are trained. In Bloomington, Police Chief Mike Dekoff says officers are undergoing training related to many subjects, including mental health and community policing. And he says there have been changes since the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, almost 2 years ago. Still, many activists and scholars have questioned whether more police training can substantially address the ongoing issues related to violence against Black Americans. Yesterday, Chief Dekoff spoke with Joe about how Bloomington officers are trained. We bring you that conversation now for today's WFHB Community Report.
When I encounter a Bloomington police officer, how much training is it fair to expect that they have? What's the minimum amount of training officer would have?
So some background information. In Indiana, law enforcement officers are required to have 40 hours of continuing education training a year. On average, Bloomington police officers receive over 100 hours a year. And that's on a variety of different topics. Some of the use of force type training that we do, our officers carry pepper spray. They have batons. So there's some less lethal stuff that we use that they receive training on. But we spend a lot of training time on firearms training. And we cover a variety of different things. There's how to handle the weapon safely, how to fire while you're moving. There's been a lot of, you can see on TV, police moving behind cover and down the street and stuff. So we train on how to operate the weapon in those types of situations, training on how to use cover to protect not only you, but maybe someone that you're someone else, a citizen you might be protecting. We do low light shooting. We do weapon malfunctions. Those do happen. There's a lot of time spent on shoot, don't shoot decision making.
When you say shoot, don't shoot training, what does that mean?
There are a variety of different types of those trainings out there. Some of them are video-based, where it's like you're in a life-size video game. There are scenarios that play out. So it could be a car stop. It could be you're responding to a domestic call. And so the officers have to make a judgment on how they're going to respond. And on some of those trainings, the training officers can control, based upon what the officer is doing, how that video plays out. So if the officer is using verbal commands appropriately, is positioning himself appropriately, the training officer can make that situation de-escalate. But if the officer's not, then the training officer can take a different route and escalate the situation with who the officer is responding to. And so, if it's something where the officer is using good communication skills and things like that, then we reinforce that and we talk about that with the officers so that they know, okay, see, this is a proper way we want people to do things versus escalating a situation, which could end up becoming a use of force type situation.
So let's talk about that use of force type situation. Under what conditions would an officer be trained that they are justified in discharging a weapon?
Well, there's not really a simple answer for that because each individual situation, you have to look at the facts for each one. We train in a framework that is a circular type of use of force. So if someone is escalating a situation, then the officers are trained to also use what they need to control that situation and bring that situation back under control.
And what, when you say escalating a situation, what would that mean?
So let's say you and I are, I'm the police officer, you're the citizen, and there's a complaint that's called in on you about that you have a gun and that you are waving it around. So I show up on the scene and I start to approach you and I start to talk to you and it's very conversational. It's not escalated or anything like that. And then I start asking you questions about, you know, we got a complaint that you were waving a gun around, and you start to get more agitated. You know, our officers are trained to watch, you know, those types of cues so that there's a lot of things they're evaluating. They're trying to evaluate, is there some kind of mental problem here? Is it a false complaint? What is it? And so we'll start talking about those things. And if you start to get really agitated and you start putting your hands in your pockets, then the officers are going to be more concerned because, first of all, we haven't established if you have a gun yet. And so we're going to try to figure that out. But if you start pulling things out of your pocket, that's going to start to make the officer nervous. It's going to make me nervous because I don't know if you do have a gun or not. So I'm going to start being more forceful on how I might talk to you. I might try to secure your hands or something like that just to make sure about where that gun is. So we try to match whatever force whoever we're dealing with might be using.
Would an officer ever be trained to fire a gun at a person without first seeing that that person has a gun?
You mean the police just shoot before anything happens?
But before they know that the person has a gun. Does someone have to have a gun to warrant being fired at?
I'm not sure I'm following your question.
So
our officers would not be trained to immediately show up at a scene and start shooting at people.
Not immediately, but that has happened around the country. That's a thing that we know has occurred. So that's partly what I'm asking, but I'm also saying how much threat needs to be present for the officer in order to warrant discharging the firearm.
And again, each situation has to be examined on its own merits. So there are different things that happen. We provide training to our officers to try to evaluate everything that they're doing so that when they do show up, they can make those decisions. It would not be common for an officer to show up and immediately start shooting. There has to be some reason. The officer's life has to be put at risk. A citizen's life has to be put at risk. You know, those are the types of things that we do, that we train for, so that the officers are making the proper decisions.
But is it necessary, in order for me as a citizen to end up being shot by a police officer, is it necessary for me to have a gun? You know, is it possible for me to present a lethal threat without having a gun?
There are situations that happen where, you know, the person could be much larger than the officer. We have some female officers. You know, if the person is not armed and they're going for the officer's firearm, you know, that would be a situation where someone might get shot. So there are a multitude of things that could happen where someone may not be armed and they still may be shot by the police.
And when a police officer fires a weapon, where are they trained to fire at on a person?
Usually it's center mass, but a lot of times it may be a situation where they're behind something, but usually they're trained to shoot for center mass.
And are police ever trained to fire at someone's leg or at an arm instead of firing what's more likely to be a fatal shot in the center of the mass?
We train to shoot to stop the aggressive behavior. So if it would be, you know, to shoot a leg, you don't normally train for a specific part of the body because that's hard to do. So you shoot for center mass. So if that's all that you see is a leg sticking out, then that might be appropriate to do. But normally police officers are trained to shoot center mass.
To be clear, in order for a weapon to be discharged, there must be a threat against the officer or against another person at the scene, right?
Well, that's how we train. I can't speak for other departments, but that's how we train.
And does it have to be a lethal threat or a threat of injury?
It's a threat.
Any kind of threat?
It's a threat to someone's safety and to their life.
I've been speaking with Chief Dekoff of the Bloomington Police. Chief, thanks for talking with us today.
Okay, thanks.
That was WFHB News Director Joe Crawford speaking with Bloomington Police Chief Mike Dekoff. You can hear an extended version of Joe's conversation with Chief Dekoff on our website at WFHB.org.
Coming up next, WFHB's weekly financial segment, The Ins and Outs of Money.
It's The Ins and Outs of Money, presented by the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. Quick tips for getting control of your money, no matter how big or small your income or family is.
Hello, and welcome to The Ins and Outs of Money. I'm Christina with the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. When you go through your budget each month, how much do you allocate to your emergency fund? $10? 10%? Not a dime? Financial experts agree that an emergency fund is a necessary tool for anyone wanting to get control of their finances. An emergency fund protects you from the financial fallout of layoffs, hour reductions, and you guessed it, emergencies. Keep in mind that when we say emergencies, we are talking about car accidents, not car maintenance. Car maintenance is an example of an expense that anyone who owns a car should start budgeting for, because after a while, it is inevitable. Why are emergency funds important? 37% of Americans in a recent poll said that they have credit card debt that is equal to or greater than the amount that they have in savings. In other words, more than 1 in 3 Americans would be thrown into financial turmoil if they were hit with a high medical bill or other unexpected emergency. So how much is too much emergency savings and how much is too little? Old pre-2008 advice suggested that a 3 to 6 month safety net was good enough. So if you took home $2,000 a month, you would need $6,000 to $12,000 in backup savings. But today's advice suggests that something closer to 6 to 9 months savings is needed. 6 to 9 months, you were thinking? But that is a substantial chunk of change. This advice is partially based on the U.S. Labor Department's unemployment statistics from August 2015, which tell us that 27% of the unemployed have been jobless for longer than 27 weeks, or 6 months. For someone making $2,000 a month and saving 10% of their income, it would take 7.5 years to save $18,000, which is 9 months' savings, and chances are that an emergency would crop up in that time that could tap that account. So what are your options? The trick with most emergency accounts is that they need to be liquid. In other words, you need to have the cash available immediately. So some advisors suggest using a combination of cash and credit to prepare for any eventuality, and this can be a good option for some. One important thing to keep in mind is that even if you were to get a large portion of cash saved, if it's just sitting in a traditional savings account, it's making little to no interest and not working for you at all. Some helpful alternatives are to look into online savings accounts, which can give someone closer to 1% interest per year, or to create a CD ladder. And what's a CD ladder exactly? Well, CD stands for Certificate of Deposit, and it's sold by banks and credit unions. It's also called a term or time deposit because when you buy a CD, you are telling the bank that they can have your money for a set time, say 1 to 5 years, and in exchange, they are giving you an interest rate that's typically a little better than a savings account would be. So where's the ladder come in with these CDs? Say you have $10,000 saved up. You'd actually buy 5 $2,000 CDs, but you'd get one as a 1-year CD, another one as a 2-year CD, a 3-year, a 4-year, and a 5-year CD. After 1 year, you'd cash in that 1-year CD you bought, which is now worth a little bit more because of the interest, and you'd immediately buy a 5-year CD with that money. You keep doing that every year, cashing in the CD that's matured and buying a 5-year CD with the money. If you can do that over a period of decades, you'll do two good things for yourself. One is, you're allowing those CDs to collect more and more interest as they rotate up the ladder towards maturity, so their total worth keeps going up and up. Two, you'll always have that CD on the top rung of the ladder, the one that's maturing this year, to cash in for quick emergency money. If things really get bad, you can always cash in all your CDs on the ladder, of course, but you'll pay a penalty for cashing them in early. All of this seem overwhelming? Just start small. Save maybe $100 a month for a year, and you'll have money in the bank at the end of the year. And you'll be on the road towards creating a financial peace of mind you deserve. Making the decision to start and sticking with it is how to build wealth over time.
The Ins and Outs of Money is part of the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. It's produced by Ryan Stacey at Level Up, the Digital Creativity Center at the library. Executive producers Joe Crawford and Dan Witherid is our sound editor. Music courtesy of Flannel Graph Records. Tools for taking control of your money can be found at money.mcpl.info. That's money.mcpl, as in Monroe County Public Library.info.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Taylor Haggerty and Jared Dill, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services.
Our engineer is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
And I'm Joe Crawford. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming, online at wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Interchange, Bloomington Community Radio's longest-running public affairs program, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.